Hi everyone, this is Sol Daniela, aka Sol, and you're listening to Notes from a Native Daughter, the late 2021 edition. You can listen to this podcast in Audioboom. Today's guest is the amazing veteran documentary filmmaker Adriana Bosch. We speak about her latest beautiful film, Ode to José Lezama Lima, titled José Lezama Lima, Letters to Eloisa. This is a heartfelt conversation that is worth your time. Adriana, thank you, and I hope you enjoy it. Adriana, I feel like, you know, I've known your work through the years.
Thank you.
You know, a little bit. I participated thanks to Neida Martinez, who worked as part of the outreach team for Latino Americans in the essay dimension of the project. I was one of the people that she invited to contribute. And that for me was like, oh my God, it was such an honor. And it was great. And I love the series.
Well, thank you. You know, we worked, that was a very special moment, I think, for us. For me, as a producer, I think for the entire team, I think that we all felt, which is great because it drives you in a way. We all felt like we were doing something important and something new and something that, you know, should have been done, but had never been done. So I remember that was at the time when, right after the big collapse in 2008. And I remember Monica Navarro, who was one of the co-producers in the show. And she would, you know, always coming to the office and, you know, no matter what trouble we got in, she would say, too big to fail, too big to fail. And I think that in some way we were all driven by that sense of, you know, of having given this mission that was way overdue and that, you know, no matter what, we were going to pull through and do something that meant something and that really gave some, you know, spread some light in a sense about the Latino narrative and not just in a separate way, but integrated into American history. I remember, and I'm quoting Santana here, you know, from another show where he says, that was the biggest door I ever went through. And I always felt that that show was the biggest door I ever went through. And I have tried to recapture that sort of sense of real mission that we had in that show. And you know, I think it's a once in a lifetime thing when you are entrusted with something that you really feel is of tremendous importance and that not just out of, you know, the diente pa fuera, but for real, you feel a sense of mission and that you no time, no expense of personal expense, nothing was going to stand in the way of making this work.
That's amazing. But the sense of mission to tell the stories, I mean, that is definitely, it drives you somehow because what you have, you know, also done. I watched Jimmy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
I love him and I love the work. And also the series on music, Latino USA.
Yes.
Which is also, you know, so lyrical. And so I thank you for you know, that gumption that you have that can you tell me where it comes from?
Well, you know, I don't know where it comes from. I think you find it. I think this is something you find when it is a question of, to me, ultimately, of feeling that this has been entrusted to you, and that you have to find the energy and the impulse and everything else somewhere, because, you know, literally you cannot fail. And it's not only you, you're part of a team. Production work is teamwork. And so you create this kind of collective engagement, but obligation to one another, not just to the story, not just to the audience, not just to the fact that you have been given this work to do, but to your peers, to, you know, to the other producers, to your executive producer, to your editors, to everyone who has a hand in the show, to the artists in Latin Music USA. And I thought that at that time, we were really kind of ahead of the curve. That was really the first time that PBS went out there and did this kind of major, I mean, 4 hours on the history of Latinos, because in the end, it was a history about the history of music, but it wasn't. You know, it was a history of Latinos told through one of the most important Latino creations in the United States, which is music. And we were very aware of what we were doing, that we were opening a door to the contribution of Latinos to the United States. And this was, you know, 2007, 2008. And it was that moment. You had, earlier you had this Latino explosion on the Hispanic moment in the music market, but this was not exactly that. This was, let's go back and try to tell our story through our creation. And that's what we set out to do. And to make it entertainment, and to make entertaining, and to make the music count. And also to use the resources that we had from PBS, and, you know, and do something that really carry the weight of that. I mean, independent producers, as you know, struggle mightily with very little money, sometimes with very few resources, to do something that is great. And I think that, you know, now I've had that experience as well, and it's a very different experience. And but when you have the backing of a GBH, when you have the backing of CPB, of PBS, you need to come through, and you need to show the world and show the audience that when Latinos get, you know, that kind of hump, that kind of, you know, let's be frank, money, resources, mm-hmm. we can do as much, we can do better. And we can take a series like Latin Music USA that, you know, stands there with the very best.
Absolutely.
You know, and we are all of us who worked on that are really proud of it, just like Latino Americans. I think we're all of us are really proud of what we did with that. I remember when being in Washington, and we were going to go into the White House, and there was a terrorist threat, and so the event was canceled. And I remember that same day, the Washington Post, I think, wrote on Latin Americans, and the article said, "This series is the, you know, gives you the best that PBS does. This time is being done by Latinos." And I was so proud of that. You know, I was just so proud of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, it felt really, really great to have that kind of recognition and to have that kind of voice. Of course, there's been a lot of work done since. And I think, you know, we have hit great strides in production, in filmmaking everywhere. And every time the challenge gets a little, the bar gets a little higher, the challenge gets a little more difficult. And you have to keep on your toes, because there's an entire generation of filmmakers
yeah.
that are coming up, that are doing really terrific cutting edge work and really important work for mm-hmm. Latinos and the community.
I agree. But you're very much there. And, you know,
I'm old now, you know. I'm one of, you know, I think I'm sort of like in, you know, I'm not a, I feel like I'm no longer in the vanguard. I'm sort of, you know, kind of in somewhere with the pioneers, if you may, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, at least not, you know, not in the sense of being the original, you know, hardcore filmmakers that really killed themselves to get things done, but to actually get these Latino voices in on PBS, on a major, on the major stage. And, you know, we did do that. We did do that.
Yes. Credit where credit is due. That is inspiring. This, you know, poem, letter, docu-profile.
Oh, God, yeah.
Of Lezama is very beautiful. I really loved that it has this very lyrical rhythm, cadence, as it unfolds the story that moved me to tears. By the end, olvídate, I was very, very taken. I read that in one of the PBS areas that you said, my objective was to break through that. There are conflicting narratives about the Cuban Revolution. There is mm-hmm. narrative. And then you say, my objective was to break through that and to try to take out each narrative, what seemed to be historically accurate, and to try to construct other narratives that took right. into account all sides.
That I said when I did a far more controversial document than Letters to Eloisa, when I did Fidel Castro, where I was really confronted with this, you know, stereo of opinion. And so I tried to kind of be deaf to that, though it was very hard, and try to tell the story as it was. I kind of try to apply the same principle to Lezama. This time, I knew, you know, doing something on Fidel Castro was almost impossible to do both sides of the Cuban community, both the right. exiles and right. the people in Cuba. When it came to Lezama, it was much easier to do that. By the time that I started producing Lezama Lima, there was an opening in Cuba in a way. And a lot of the questions that existed about his life and what happened to him and his literature and the entire trajectory of José Lezama Lima was being talked about in Cuba, you know, in different, a little more subtle, but a lot more subtly, and with a different cover than it was being talked about by the people here in exile. By the, you know, by the people who love Lezama. But the common denominator there was that everyone loved Lezama. So, you know, that's a lot easier to do than if some people hate Lezama and some people love Lezama, because you don't want to take your audience into this whipsaw, you know? You kind of whiplash, right?
Yeah.
Whiplash. Whiplash, and you don't want to have them go, okay, yes, no, yes, no, because then your story gets totally, you know, like you feel like you're living in strobe lights. So I was very, this was really very clear to me. I was doing a piece where the people who were giving testimony had one thing in common, and it was the love for the protagonist. And whether they were in Cuba, whether they were in Miami, whether they were in California, they all felt for him. And they all felt that an injustice had been committed. So for one rare moment, you had these two sets of people really kind of on the same page. And I was able to seamlessly weave together this narrative where you have, and you know, where you have Reynaldo Gonzalez, who's sitting in a restaurant in Havana in 2013, and you have, you know, Enrique Mario Santi in California, in Berkeley, in 2017, and they complement each other. They're not saying exactly the same thing, but they're saying the same thing. And I thought that was that's a very rewarding. I mean, you get stuck in the details and the nitty gritty of production. You know, lately I've been stuck in the clearances and the subtitles that inevitably are full of typos because, you know, yeah, they just are. Yeah. And then you have to, and so you get stuck in the minutia of production. And then you take a step back. You begin to really understand what it is about what you have done that is different and rewarding. And I think in the case of Lezama, the fact that this crosses both sides, that it is a seamless portrait of the fate of a man within a system that went awry, told from the people who love them inside and outside of Cuba, is ultimately its great success. I don't know if I could have or would have made this documentary without those voices, because it would have felt to me like you're applauding with that single hand, and mm-hmm. and you don't have the kind of resonance of the people who are still kind of living within Cuba, that, you know, that went through what he went through, and that even with the constraints at the time, and even worse now, but then trying to rescue the memory of this man and being honest and brave, yeah, about saying, this is what was happening and this is what happened, and it's unforgivable, you yeah. know? And mm-hmm. so that's what I think makes this show different from a lot of things that have been done about Cuba. I remember reading many years ago in the New Yorker, an article on documentary filmmaking, and that basically it asked the question, is there such a thing as an objective documentary? And the answer was no, because a producer that was going to a filmmaker who is going to put so much of him or herself into a documentary, has something to say. But I think what can be, you know, that needs to be measured in a way, at least in my old fashioned way of looking at things. The way I try to deal with my own voice is I try to present it as objectively as I can. Even though I am making an argument, I'm making the argument that here was a man who welcomed a change in Cuba that to him seemed to be, to point toward a future that was better than he had experienced in his own life. And in fact, that didn't come through. At the beginning, yes, there was a lot of hope and he willingly participated in everything. And then little by little, he began to fall out of step with a revolution that was getting narrower and narrower and narrower, and where the space for creativity and the space for freedom and the space for self-definition was narrowing down. Mm-hmm. And he suffered tremendously yes. on account of that. And that's the story I told. But that story isn't told. I try not to be strident about it. No. I think it's a story that tells itself mm-hmm. in a very human way, and mm-hmm. and in there that humanity comes through, not just through the interviews and the voices of everyone who loves them, but it comes through in correspondence. And correspondence is a terrific tool to get to someone's inner emotions, and I had that, and I felt I was given a gift when I ran into those letters. And let me stop, because I'll just get on with it. And, you know, and I want to I want to, you know, actually have a conversation rather than a monologue here, you know?
No, but this is fantastic. Actually, I was going to ask you, how long did it take you to produce the film? I guess from when you get the idea, how did you decide, and then to now? What's that arc?
This was an accident. I was finishing up Fidel Castro, and I had been given by one of my characters in one of my interviewees, Carlos Franchi, who was very close to the revolution. And then in 1966, 67, he kind of broke away. He had given me this little book that was called Letters to Eloise. And I was just like literally cleaning up after finishing Fidel. And I run into this little book and I start reading the letters. And this is 2006. And I start reading these letters and I look at it and I felt like, oh my God, this is the only documentary this is the documentary I was almost born to make. It seemed like my entire career had led me to this discovery of this correspondence, that letters that he had written to his sister between 61 and 76, and that his sister published after his death. And I was just overwhelmed. Number one, by the writing. I mean, Lezama's writing can be very dense, but in these letters, it's intimate. And it is still very high. You know, he talks about Nietzsche. He talks about, you know, the great priests that used to, you know, swell the waters of the Tigris with their tears. He, you know, his metaphors are always mythical and historical, but the tone and the intimacy of the letters is wonderful. And in these letters, there are two things that happen that I think are fascinating. One, you begin to see his own transformation and it's his own disillusionment with the situation in Cuba. And number two, you learn of his tragedy. You learn how he, you know, sometimes in a veiled way, just opens his heart to his sister. You know, they're in their essence, these letters are love letters. Mm-hmm. Because what really threads them together is this tremendous desire, this pining and pining of a brother for his sister, which, you know, I think to Latinos, that's a very familiar theme. We all buy,
yeah,
you know, for the people that were left behind and the people that went away. And in his case, at the time in Cuba, you couldn't leave, you know, it was impossible to leave Cuba, really, between 62 and 76, except, you know, there was a little time there with the freedom flights when people could leave. But he was not allowed to leave Cuba. After he publishes Paradiso in 66, and he becomes this increasingly popular and known figure across the world, the Cuban government begins to tighten El Cerco. They begin to isolate him increasingly. And at one point, they just won't let him, that he wants to leave Cuba. They won't let him go. So threaded through is this desire by Lezama to take advantage of all these invitations that are raining on him because of who he has become, because of this controversial and wonderful novel he has written. And on the other hand, a state that fears that he might, we don't really know, that he might not come back, that he might defect, or that he might not say things that are favorable. He might say something unfavorable to the revolution, or simply that because he is gay, I mean, something that is not publicly known, but obviously he has written a very homoerotic novel, that in you know, that they don't want him to be the representative of the Cuban Revolution abroad.
Right.
I mean, there are many interpretations of this, and at any rate, they don't let him leave, and you see him getting more and more sullen. You see him getting more and more desperate. You see the letters, you know, and the letters begin to draw that picture for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was incredibly powerful. At one point, I felt like I was reading the diary of Anne Frank. You know, I mean, there was this, you know, it's somebody who's trapped.
Yeah.
And you can hear it on the outside. You can hear things getting worse and getting worse. And he's trapped, and you know, inevitably, well, you know the ending, of course, but even if you didn't, you can feel the demise of this person through the letters that he writes to his sister. They're very poignant moments, and some of them, unfortunately, I just couldn't get into the documentary because I had so much groundwork
to
lay.
Right.
I mean, I needed to explain to people who he was, why he was important, what the revolution did, and how it changed and how it transformed into something that he was no longer part of. That took a lot of real estate in the documentary. But there was one letter in particular that I remember when I was beginning to, and it may still happen again, when I was beginning to write this film, every time I got to that letter, inevitably I would cry. And I'm talking about versions and versions of this script. And it's a letter that he writes his sister in September 1975. And he dies less than a year later. And the letter essentially says, today, in the title, in the headlines of the Granma, they say, Eloisa is coming. And for one moment, I indulged myself thinking that it was you that was coming back to share with us your company and your happiness. They were referring to a hurricane, Huracán Eloisa. And every time I got there, I just started crying because to me, that just cut through tremendously. There are two versions of this film. One version is the version that is going to be broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the other version is the version that I did for distribution where I couldn't use certain things because they were under fair use. But in the end, it is about that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, in the end, it's about pain, it's about family separation, it is about freedom,
mm-hmm.
personal freedom, artistic freedom, freedom of thought. And it is about what it is that it does to a human soul to be denied those things that we, you know, ourselves take for granted. Now, his story is not particular to Cuba. His story is repeated and multiplied across the world. I mean, leftist, rightist, you know, homophobic, you know, any place where democracy doesn't exist and where authoritarianism rules the day. The story of Lezama Lima is the story of intellectuals. You read it so many times, so many places. And what made it special for me was not just that he was Cuban, although of course that's who I am, but the fact that, oh my God, and this guy wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Puño y letra. I mean, I didn't know how to translate that, otherwise the film would be called that.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that's a difficult one.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote all of this. And so all you had to do was look at those letters and all of this. I didn't have to have people tell you, well, I thought, although, you know, a lot of that helps and it's in the documentary, but you had that, you know, that beautiful window into this remarkable soul.
A literary man, a man
a
of
literary,
word.
A poet.
A poet. And a and the film poet. The film captures that, Adriana. It's a poem. It carries you all the way through. In a very beautiful way. Like you took, I think it felt like that to me, right? That there was a melody to it, and each letter as it was introduced, and each chapter and each little bit of less and each little bit of less was coming through very
a little bit of less, you said?
Yeah.
What a wonderful thing to say. Yes, a little bit of less. Yes.
A little bit of less. And just that progression seemed very poetic, you know, and I guess the last question really is about how did you choose his poetry, the poetry that you did choose, the selected ones, let's say. How was that process?
Well, let me tell you, it was the literature presented the biggest challenge in this film, to actually try to convey some of what made him great without, you know, getting too much into it, because it could have taken over the film, and that's not what the film was about. I needed enough in there so that you would get a sense of him and you would get a sense of what he wrote and how he wrote. So I selected his first poem. I selected that had to be there. And then I selected this lovely piece about Noche Insular, Jardines Invisibles, because it really was about Cuba. And so you had the opportunity to actually be there and to get a glimpse of how it is that he saw the island and how it is that his metaphors of Cuba opened you to a different kind of experience of Cuba. The third time that you read his poetry, that you hear him, he's explaining his poetry. He's explaining that poem, Noche Insular, Jardines Invisibles, Insular Night, Invisible Gardens. And, you know, and it's a line I didn't use ultimately because it's been so used. And then I think, well, by whom and who knows it? But, you know, he says, es que nacer aquí es una fiesta innombrable. You know, to be born here is an unmeasurable feast. And I, you know, and it was about his love for his island and his love for the content, the invisible and the feel of his island and the spaces, the secrets, as he says, you know, the stuff that you don't get right away, but it takes you a lifetime to and to be him, to be able to learn and embody. And I went after those images. I started looking for that Havana. I mean, I didn't want to have, the other Havana. I wanted to show the audience, in a sense, a Havana that had a feeling of Lezama. And I think that became very, very important part of the film. In terms of Paradiso, I chose what people could relate to.
Right.
People could relate to food, that supper, that grandmother, the idea, again, Latinos, the idea of family, and family at the center. I love that more than anything else in this film. When after Vargas Llosa talks about how a narrative was hidden behind this cathedral of prose and poetry. And the other guy comes in and says, it's about the family.
Yeah.
The family at the center of human life and how the family is the vehicle by which culture is passed along generations and how central it is to his life, to our lives. And then, of course, I had to go for the controversy, which was the homophobia right. and the homoeroticism of Paradiso. And that occupies, I think, a nice chunk of the film. And it had to be done because ultimately, who are we if not that? You know, we are erotic beings only because, you know, we reproduce. That's how the species gets carried along. And also it's what created controversy for him. And I think it was the beginning of his troubles. I think that the fact that he published this book and at a time when what he was writing was against what the government wanted to present to the world, the image of Cuba that the government had to present to the world. And you had this book, you know, becoming incredibly popular across the island. Yeah. And it created a conflict that was inevitable. And then he was never again truly trusted after that, I think. I think that everything that happened to him ultimately stemmed from that. Really, I don't want people to be, this has always been my fear with this documentary. José Lezama Lima, an obscure writer, obscured. And that's something a colleague of mine here in Miami wrote, and I thought it was brilliant. An obscure writer, well, you know, then how do you tell people to watch a film about somebody they don't know? So how do you position that? How do you, and I never wanted that to be the fact that he was unknown, stand in the way of the fact that he represents millions. I mean, ultimately this is about Lezama, but this is not about Lezama. This is about us, this is about the world, this is about the need to fight against authoritarian tendencies, the need to preserve the spaces for us to be, for us to create, for us to exist, and the costs to a man or a woman or any human being of not being able to do that, and the cost to the entire culture. Because as Lilian Guerra, one of my interviewees, says, who knows what would have happened? I mean, maybe Lezama today would be as recognizable as Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You know, I mean, he belonged there, and he was never able to get out in the world and bathe in the fame of the moment, of that great Latin American literary boom, where all of these people stood on the pinnacle of the literary world, novelists. And here was José Lezama Lima, locked up in his house, not allowed to go to any give lectures or go any meetings or leave his country or speak from his own country. And so that moment where he could have become what he deserved to become was denied to him. And so to try to fix that becomes very hard.
Yeah.
And I just desperately don't want people to walk and not give an opportunity to this film because they don't know who he is, because his name is not resonant. I want them to understand that he stands for many, and that he could have been Juan de los Palotes in vez de José Lezama Lima, and I still would have made a film about him. And that's how I'd like to talk about that story.
All right, noted. And I will, when I write my essay, and I stand with you on that. I think that you did it beautifully. And so I thank you again for your time.
Well, thank you. I try to be calm, cool, and calm and collected. And I promise myself that next time I'm going to be cool, calm, and collected. And then I just get swept up in this, in this thing. I don't know how long it's going to be before I let it go, you know? Oh. But thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity, really, honestly. I really want this film to be watched. And not because I made it, you know, it's got flaws, it's not a perfect film, and it's in the end it's gonna be another film. But I really think that
La historia, Adriana, la historia.
La historia. Hay que tener las cosas hechas en la historia. You have to leave a legacy of history. And I mean, there are not many fools that would say, like, I'm going to make a film about these letters. I don't know if they're going to let me into Cuba. I don't know if I mean they're going to have access to the letters. The sister is dead. I can't interview her. But she died in the process. And, you know, anyway, I wanted her to be, let me, you know, there's something some people, you know, people have had trouble understanding. And it is, why not have Eloisa? There are interviews with Eloisa. And in the end, I wanted her to be
part of his journey
in his mind.
Yeah.
I wanted him to remember her to be a loving memory. I didn't want her to be Eloisa. I wanted her to be Lezama's Eloisa, like, you know, Don Quixote's Dulcinea. Exactly. I wanted her to be his dream, his destination. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you see her.
Yeah.
At the very end, after he dies. And, you know, I understand that. And it's about, I think, more about literature than anything else. And also, that's the sister he was writing to.
Yeah.
He was writing to the sister that left in 1961. He's beautiful and really, you know, truly the love of his life, I think. They were each other's love of each other's lives.
And, yeah.
And you know, that's what this film is. It's a love story, ultimately, between two siblings that are separated and can never reunite. No? And everything else kind of falls in between.
I concur.
Thank you. I'm indebted. I'm so happy to have met you. And I, you know, it's so rewarding to, I tell you, to meet someone that gets what you have done. That is really ultimately the most important thing when you give so much to something. To find somebody that actually gets it and appreciates it. It's a gift. Thank you.
You're welcome.